Great to have you with us here on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here. We're going to be starting the program today talking with you about Alzheimer's disease. In the U.S., it's estimated about 5.5 million people have Alzheimer's. By 2050, that number could rise to as high as 16 million. So with statistics like that, it's no wonder that we're putting some resources into researching the disease, and some of that's going on right at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. Our guest today is part of that research. Megan Zielsdorf is an assistant professor in the UW-Madison School of Nursing and an investigator in the Wisconsin Alzheimer's Disease Research Center. So we'll talk about the center, the research is going on, and what it's telling us. Certainly, if you have questions about Alzheimer's and the research, perhaps, I hope you'll join in. Number to call, 1-800-642-1234, 800-642-1234. Email us at ideas@wpr.org. And Megan Zielsdorf, welcome.
Thank you, and thanks for having me here today.
Those are really scary statistics, in my mind anyway, relating to Alzheimer's. Why is the disease progressing so rapidly? Do we know?
By that, do you mean why is the prevalence increasing?
Yes.
You know, the main reason that the prevalence is increasing is because the big baby boom generation is aging into a prime risk period. So we know that Alzheimer's disease is not a natural part of aging, but age is certainly the single biggest risk factor for developing Alzheimer's disease or other dementias. And that's the biggest reason why we're seeing these really rapidly rising numbers, is just because the population is aging overall.
I know that it can happen at even early ages, but what's the typical age for onset Alzheimer's? We have a typical age?
We don't call it late onset Alzheimer's, which is the most common kind of Alzheimer's, and what we're talking about now, unless the onset happens after the age of 65.
Okay.
And the numbers go up slowly from there. So if you imagine that about 10% of those between 65 and 75 have it, by the time you get to 85, at almost a third of the over 85 population has diagnosed dementia of some kind. So the numbers do increase as
there
people
are,
get older.
And as you're saying, there are other types of dementia, and those are increasing as well, or are they?
Sure. Pretty much age-related diseases overall tend to be increasing. And also the thing is as we can keep people alive and doing okay for longer, that's also contributing to these bigger numbers. Mm. So, you know, we don't have people dying from heart disease as much, so they're aging into this at-risk bracket more. And then once people have dementia, our care is getting better. So as people stay alive longer, there are also more people with Alzheimer's disease and dementia.
How the heck did you get involved in this, by the way?
It was kind of an accident. I started off as a researcher. I got my bachelor's degree here at the UW, and I was studying stress and health, and I knew that that was what I wanted my focus to be. And then for my first job, I ended up in a research position at Northwestern University in their Alzheimer's Disease Center, and I loved working with the patients that we were seeing there and the older adults coming in for the research studies, and I was hooked on it. It was a problem I wanted to solve. It was a patient community that I wanted to work with.
And then you wound up here at the Wisconsin Alzheimer's Disease Research Center.
I did. I started graduate school here, focused on epidemiology and public health in the Population Health Sciences Department. And I worked with our Wisconsin Registry for Alzheimer's Prevention Study to do my research as a graduate student. And I've kept on going here. I love the UW and Madison.
What kinds of studies are being conducted?
Oh, so many. So we have two big studies that go on. And one of them is the RAP study, that Wisconsin Registry for Alzheimer's Prevention, that it comes out of the Wisconsin Alzheimer's Institute. And this is one of the single biggest studies of adult children of persons with dementia. And then we also have our Alzheimer's Disease Research Center. And there we enroll a core of people who are cognitively healthy when they enroll in the study. We enroll people who have mild cognitive impairment, a precursor to dementia, and we enroll people who actually have dementia and they're seen for clinical care and they also participate in research. And so as part of those big studies, we're looking at not only the brain changes that accompany dementia and how they influence different trajectories that people's memory health might take, but we're also looking at a whole lot of midlife and later life risk and protective factors that might change those trajectories and change the relationships between brain changes and memory health.
It's really interesting. I have a friend who's in the RAP program whose mother died of Alzheimer's.
Yeah.
And I think she finds it interesting.
Oh, our participants are so wonderful. They're really invested. I think they enjoy it most of the time, which is saying a lot because it's a tough study to be in sometimes. But yeah, we have people. I think overall it's a huge plus for people.
And how many are in that program? Are in those various programs?
I believe that RAP is right around 1,700 now and is still enrolling. I think the Wisconsin Alzheimer's Disease Research Center cohort has about 900. So, it's a lot of people. And in both studies, there are people who have been with us for a really long time. So RAP really began enrolling back in 2001, and we still have some of our original participants who are keeping up their participation. So, yeah,
it's amazing, and that long, there must be some trends and things that are coming out of the work that you've been doing.
Yeah, there's a lot of really exciting research. RAP has focused on these modifiable life factors for quite a while. More recently, we've been focused a lot on the brain changes, actually, that are a big part of Alzheimer's and understanding those. But yeah, there's been really exciting research on physical activity that has come out of the RAP and the ADRC studies. There's been great research thinking about self-reported nutrition, sleep quality and sleep quantity. My studies on stress and on social ties have come out of the RAP data. We've got incredible research that we're putting out into the world and hopefully, putting into the bigger body of knowledge that we have.
Let's give our listeners a chance to join in. Questions or comments about the research or about Alzheimer's, specific questions about Alzheimer's, certainly welcome. Your questions. Megan Zielsdorf, our guest today, assistant professor at the UW-Madison School of Nursing. She's been working in the area of Alzheimer's research for quite a while now, actually, and it's great to have her with us to talk with you. Join in at 1-800-642-1234. Email us at ideas@wpr.org. Carol in Wisconsin Rapids emailed to ask if there are any new ideas concerning early diagnosis. Both of her brothers had Alzheimer's, and she's wondering if she should be paying more attention to the latest information.
I think that the general consensus in the Alzheimer's research community is that early diagnosis is always a goal, even though we're not treating Alzheimer's necessarily with drugs at this point. There's a lot of research that suggests that risk that you can see in the brain, these Alzheimer's-related brain changes, are actually, you can reduce their impact on your memory health through things like controlling blood pressure, controlling weight, keeping fit, and other things that we're currently studying. So I think the idea is that early diagnosis is great. That said, a lot of the risk factors that we're thinking about operate through more than just amyloid, this key protein that accumulates with Alzheimer's disease. And you can be modifying your lifestyle without necessarily knowing your diagnosis, because it's probably a good idea anyway in many cases.
Probably for most, well, for many people at least. Well, Rusty in Stevens Point has a question for you, so let's go there.
Okay.
Hi, Rusty, hi.
Good morning, and thank you. Say, I'm just curious. I heard recently that there may be a connection to dementia, Alzheimer's, when a person or patient is put under for any type of surgery or whatever, but when they're, you know, put down for any length of time, that there's a high rate of chance for dementia or Alzheimer's. Have you looked into that at all, or do you know anything about that?
Yeah, so they're actually, we're lucky to have Dr. Sanders with the ADRC is an anesthesiologist who is actually looking at ties between anesthesiology or anesthesia and cognitive trajectories. And then we have other people who are also very interested in medical events and how they might influence cognition. I think that there's been mixed evidence showing up, but I believe that the most current work coming out of our center suggests that the effect or the clinical significance of the of an anesthetized surgery is not very great in terms of cognitive trajectories. Just as often, because a surgery is meant to relieve, say, something like pain or an ongoing problem that could also be influencing cognition, we see benefits as often as we see detriment. That said, it's an area where, because there have been mixed findings, the research is going to be continuing. But I would say it's definitely not conclusive that you're put at risk.
There you go, Rusty. Thank you very much
for
calling.
Thanks for the question.
Yeah, good question. Dennis in Milwaukee. Your turn. Hi, Dennis.
Hello. I just have one question. How does one get into the RAP program, and what essentially are the criteria?
Good question.
We have a great website for that. If you go to... And the website may have just changed, actually. We're working on it all the time to make it easier to use for everybody. But if you go to the website for the Wisconsin Alzheimer's Institute, you'll see a link for the Wisconsin Registry for Alzheimer's Prevention that will tell you all about how you can potentially get enrolled in the study. So I recommend going there. For RAP, the exclusion criteria, they're minimal. We want to enroll people across a distribution of health and across, you know, from different areas of Wisconsin. And we keep the exclusion criteria pretty minimal for that reason. We want everybody because, you know, we're trying to increase brain health and memory health for people across a spectrum. So I would say check out the website and then contact us.
And again, the website is the Wisconsin...
It's the Wisconsin Alzheimer's Institute.
And then from there...
WAI. And then you'll be able to link really pretty quickly to the RAP study. That's the Wisconsin Registry for Alzheimer's Prevention.
There you go, Dennis. Thank you so much for calling. Appreciate your call. Megan Zielsdorf, assistant professor at the UW-Madison School of Nursing, our guest. She's an investigator in the Wisconsin Alzheimer's Disease Research Center. Again, questions, email at ideas at WPR.org or call at 1-800-642-1234. Nigel O'Shea, our engineer today, Jill Nador, our producer. I'm Larry Mueller. You're listening to the Ideas Network. Taking a look at Alzheimer's and Alzheimer's research today on the Ideas Network, I'm Larry Mueller with Megan Zielsdorf, assistant professor at the UW-Madison School of Nursing. She investigates through the Wisconsin Alzheimer's Disease Research Center. It's great to have her with us. Cheryl in Stevens Point has a question for you, so let's go there. Hi, Cheryl.
Thank you for taking my call. I had read somewhere that there's some kind of a connection between Alzheimer's and waxy ears, how important it is for people who are older to go to the doctor, get their ears checked, and that could make a difference in their cognitive, just general awareness of the world. And I would like Megan to speak to that if she could.
All right, Cheryl, thank you for calling. Megan, what's...
Well, I haven't heard about waxy ears specifically, but I wonder if it has something to do with research that has shown that hearing loss is sometimes associated with cognitive impairment or memory impairment and dementia risk. And I do think, actually, that hearing is a really key part of our interacting with the world. And as someone who studies social engagement and mechanisms by which our relationships with other people can protect us from dementia and protect our memory as we age, I can imagine how important it is to be able to hear. As we know that actually staying engaged with life is a major protective factor overall. And you can imagine all of the different kinds of protective factors that might encourage. And the minute that, you know, you're experiencing sensory loss, we know that we live in a world that is not designed for people to be able to handle that very easily. So I think that keeping, making sure that your senses, you're wearing your glasses, that your hearing is good, that your ears are cleaned out, this is a great way to maintain cognitive performance. I also would say that it becomes really hard to assess how someone is doing cognitively if hearing and hearing impairment is a part of it that we don't know about.
Yeah, that's very interesting. Cheryl, thank you so much for calling with that question. Ryan in Madison, we'll give you a chance. Hi, Ryan.
Hi, I'm wondering, my father-in-law, he's in his early 70s, and I'm wondering how I can convince him to get tested. Any hints, anything like that? He deflects it. I think he's scared. He deflects it whenever we see something or say something, and, you know, uses idioms to do it. It's like he said the other day, it's not Alzheimer's isn't where you forget where you put your keys. It's finding them in the bread box. So I'm just wondering, you know, where's a good point to start? I mean, how do we, what's some things we can say that might convince him to go and test it?
Boy, you're probably not the first person to bring that up with Megan, Ryan, and it's a very good point. How do you do it?
It is a really good question. And I think that it's not something that gets talked about enough. The way that people's personalities and the cultures that they've come up in and the type of people they are really influence their willingness and their ability to be able to talk about this and to seek help for it. And of course, that it then impacts their family members as well. I think that this is a very individual kind of thing. So you are definitely not alone. I think that approaching your own physician, your father's physician or father-in-law's physician obviously won't be able to talk to you about his health, but I think if you can ask him or his colleagues, if he has advice, I think that talking to geriatricians who really have to handle this on a daily basis, I think that could be key for you. And of course, you know, be thinking about your father-in-law's personality and certainly, I think that it sounds like you're really understanding about it, that this is frustrating, but it's also a natural part of who he is. And so I think you're off to the right foot. It really is. It's taking an individualized approach.
Yeah. And, you know, in a situation like that, maybe just if the father-in-law's doctor is kind of clued in to concerns, I mean, you can't talk about he couldn't talk about the health, but at least he'd know it. So when there's a general physical exam, there may be ways the doctor would approach it. Probably that's happened before.
Yeah, I think this is a really important reason why there's a big dialogue about just having kind of routine screening in place during, preventive care or acute care kinds of visits. And I think that this is a big reason is that, so then it doesn't necessarily fall on the family members to kind of force the issue. It's just part of daily life.
Yeah,
right.
Part of the yearly physical or whatever.
Right. Because, yeah, absolutely, destigmatizing is a big part of it, and making it routine is helpful in that.
Yeah, absolutely. Good luck, Ryan. Thank you so much. Well, Elizabeth in Green Bay, you are next. Hi, Elizabeth. Oh, we lose Elizabeth? Not hearing Elizabeth. Let's try. We'll try to come back to you, Elizabeth, if you're actually there. Bob and Racine, your turn. Hi, Bob.
Hello. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Your show is remarkable. I want to make a brief comment. I'm listening as I travel about the anesthesia. I'm scheduled for major spinal surgery in Chicago at Rush University at the end of this month. And I asked my neurosurgeon about that very issue, because I have a sister that died of complications of dementia at age 75, a brilliant woman. My neurosurgeon, who I have much respect for, said, we don't encounter that problem with spinal surgery. If there is any such connection, we find it to be more relevant with cardiac surgery. Apparently, and I correct me if I'm wrong, it might be a different type of anesthesia, but he gave me the impression that it depends on the surgery.
Hmm. Interesting.
I think this isn't my area of study, but I think that one thing to keep in mind when we're talking about surgery is that there are actually a lot of different factors going into a surgery, and it's more than the anesthesia. It's the hospitalization, which can be stressful. It's changes in activity that follow that. It's changes in mobility that follow that. So I think that when we would, it very well could be that the cognitive trajectories vary by the kinds of surgery. And certainly that's an area that we need to explore more. But I think that it could be different mechanisms in play for each one. And I think there's increasing evidence that anesthesia is not a well-established risk factor for in any case.
Well, surgeries, you know, you do deal with stress. And what's more stressful to an individual than surgery or the contemplating it?
Right. That it's absolutely true. And we know that delirium risk increases in some populations following any kind of hospitalization. And delirium is certainly a risk factor for cognitive declines. Most people recover from it just fine, but we do know that it's a risk factor. And we're not sure yet. But yes, hospitalizations are a big nexus of, you know, a lot of good stuff, but also some potential risk.
Yeah, absolutely. Bob, thank you very much. Appreciate it. Lois in Chippewa Falls, it's your turn. Hi, Lois.
Hello. My husband has Alzheimer's, and I was given a book saying The End of Alzheimer's by Dr. Brennison. And he's saying that if you do all these major testing, you can find out, do omega vitamins and eating properly with special foods and... Do you know if there's any ground to this research? It's very frustrating because I would love to, you know, help my husband, but I'm thinking at this point it's too late. But what are your thoughts?
I think it's never too late. I think that, you know, the outcomes certainly change, but I think that doing what you can is always a healthy choice for everyone. In terms of diet, I think you may have asked about taking tests to find out what kind of diet is best for you, and I'm sorry if I misheard that. I don't think there's a lot of good evidence for that, but there actually is very strong evidence that eating what is called the MIND diet, this is a combination of a Mediterranean diet and a DASH diet for cardiovascular health. There's actually very strong evidence that eating this diet that's high in berries, in grains, in fruits and vegetables, especially leafy vegetables, that this actually is protective of brain health. And that is going to be true across the spectrum, whether you are a 48-year-old person or whether you are in your 70s and you have Alzheimer's already. So I think looking in it is the MIND, M-I-N-D And I think it's worth exploring if it's something that your husband is interested in.
Oh, there you go, Lois. Something to consider for sure. The Mind Diet, is that what it's called?
It is, yeah. It's the Mediterranean dash... Oh, no.
Well,
I'm not
mind
sure.
Mind is a lot easier to remember.
Mind is easier, yeah.
Oh, thank you, Lois. Appreciate it. John in Middleton will give you a chance. Hi, John.
Yes, I had a comment on the people who are calling about anesthesia. I used to work as a nurse anesthetist and had done anesthesia with open heart patients. It seems most of the anesthesia issues are more of a delirium issue. They're still doing studies on long-term effects, but especially like with an open heart surgery where you're put on bypass where an actual machine is giving your blood oxygen. There's been documentation of a condition called pump head where their speculation of some of the little micro coagulation does come from the bypass machine. So some people will notice that they'll have some cognitive difficulties anywhere from a month to 6 months out. And some of the more progressive cardiac departments will actually do a mental sort of screen test prior to going on and then follow them through to see how their memory is developing after those surgeries. But presenter right now, it seems like the actual anesthesia issue to the Alzheimer issue are kind of two separate things right now.
Yeah. Well, thanks very much, John. Any
thank
comment there,
in.
Megan?
I want to thank John for calling and giving us his information in just a second that delirium is a huge issue right now that we are considering in dementia and understanding whether delirium is arising because of previously existing risk or whether it is its own thing. And in any case, what we can do for patients who do become delirious following a hospitalization, what we can do to reduce their risk of that becoming a state that continues and sees cognitive decline follow. Delirium is big right now in terms of really trying to understand it.
And I've just mentioned in passing here that we will be talking about heart health in 10 minutes or so. So it's kind of a good segue, I think, coming up for us here on the Ideas Network. John, thanks again. Appreciate your input. Elizabeth in Green Bay. Hello.
Hi. My friend got, can you hear me?
Yes.
My friend got diagnosed with CJD, Creutzfeldt-Jakob's disease. Is that the same as accelerated Alzheimer's? The only thing is they give him 6 months to a year once symptomatic, and she's classic going down real fast.
Yeah.
Her mother had Alzheimer's at 85. Her two aunts had Alzheimer's in the 80s, but she's only 65. And are you familiar with this? Some also say mad cow disease.
Yeah.
Well, it's similar kind of symptoms, a different...
It's similar symptoms that emerge, but yeah, it's a little bit different in that it's a prion disease, and so it can strike pretty much, it's not age-related, and it can really strike anyone, and I don't believe that it causes the amyloid and tau proteins. I think what it really does is because it is a form of encephalopathy, it causes massive damage to the brain tissues really quickly. And I am so sorry to hear that it's happening, but it's a little different than Alzheimer's disease. But yes, you absolutely will see that the memory and personality changes.
Yeah, it's too bad.
With CJD.
I actually lost a couple of friends to that disease within a year, Creutzfeldt-Jakob, and they were both in their 50s. So it can happen anytime.
It's really hard.
Very, and there's no cure. So Elizabeth, thank you. I'm sorry for your friend and for your loss as well. Appreciate your call. Mike in Milwaukee, it's your turn. Hi, Mike.
Well, hello. I'm a pianist and I play in memory units. And I noticed that people that can't remember their names do remember the lyrics to the song. What's going on?
Yeah, interesting.
That's because there are different types of memory and the way that we store memories. And how we usually talk about it in the cognitive aging or the memory aging field is that there is what we call crystallized memory and crystallized knowledge, and then there's fluid knowledge. There's things that we do, like when you're talking to me and I'm remembering what you're saying so that I can respond to you. That's a very fluid kind of memory. But what is, and that's the actually where we see the majority of changes, and certainly any changes happening in early old age, we see in fluid knowledge and memory. What you're talking about, where you're remembering a song that maybe you knew many years ago, this is crystallized. It's in there, and it's a different. It's to some extent, it's different parts of the brain. It's different storage systems, and it's not as vulnerable. So you will see people maintain their memory for events that happened long ago, or their memory for skills and activities and how to do them well into the progression of dementia. People do maintain so much. We see what they lose, but we don't think about everything that they're maintaining. And music is a big is definitely part of that.
And Mike, thank you so much for that call, and for your music. It's got to be helpful to many people. Peter in Madison emailed that if there's research suggesting sleep medications like Ambien as a potential risk factor for the onset of dementia or Alzheimer's.
Yeah, I don't want to talk about mechanisms here because it's not my area, but I know that there is quite a lot of geriatrician advocacy against taking sleep medications or things that do the same thing like antihistamines. So Tylenol PM, Benadryl, these kinds of things are not good for brain health in older adults. And they can certainly inhibit cognitive function in the moment, and they may actually influence the rate of decline, and people may decline faster. So, yeah, I don't want to talk about mechanisms because it's not my area, but I can definitely second that. I see it a lot coming from our geriatricians and physicians.
Leslie emailed to ask if you're familiar with studies based on photobiomodulation or PBM device, in particular neurogamma devices put out by Violite.
I can answer that really quickly. I'm not familiar with it.
Okay.
I'm sorry about that.
That's all right.
I'll look it up as soon as this is over.
Sorry,
Leslie.
Let's go to Susan in Madison. Hi, Susan.
Hi. Thank you so much. I called because that previous caller talked about The End of Alzheimer's, the book by Dr. Dale Bredesen, and I've read that, and I think it's just wonderful. And if people want to know more, they can go online and look for him, but also or read the book. Functional Medicine Institute, he recommends seeing a doctor that's part of the Functional Medicine Institute, and that's how I found a practitioner here in Madison that does it. And because, as the woman said, there's all these blood tests you can do, and I can't do them myself, and so I went through that. And my mother has dementia, and I don't want to have the same problem. And I will say that I was having some memory problems, and once I started taking the herbs that he advised, I did get better. I don't have those problems anymore. So I really recommend that people read that book, The End of Alzheimer's. And it's a 36-point program. It's diet, it's supplements, exercise, stress reduction, and more. And if you think, oh, I could never make all those changes, he has a story in there about one patient and details what she did do and what she didn't do, and she still got better. He makes the point, if you just tip the balance towards preserving your brain or making new nerves, then, you know, you're staying ahead of the game, even if you're not perfect. And it's a very hopeful book. I hope people will read it.
Oh, thank you, Susan.
I think, you know, I think you just made a point that is so valuable. And as a public health person, it's what I try to tell people all the time. We are hearing recommendations all the time, and it can feel really overwhelming, especially if you have physical limitations that, you know, affect what you can do in your home. If you have a personality where you don't want to go out and make a lot of new friends or join a club, I think it's really important for people to recognize that making any change or making a small change is just fine. It's better than the opposite. And you don't need to do everything that is recommended to you. Make the changes that you can make. And, you know, I'm always asking my participants, you know, okay, if you're not doing this, why? Tell me the things that make it hard. Because as researchers and as clinicians, one of our main goals needs to be to help people make healthy choices by giving them the resources to do so and making sure that there are always opportunities regardless of what limitations or constraints might be in place.
Yeah.
It's a great point.
Yeah. Great point. Thank you, Susan. Angie in Milwaukee, we'll give you a chance. Hi, Angie.
Hi. Thanks for this show. This is great. I in my professional life, I work with people with dementia and Alzheimer's. I, unfortunately, also, my father had dementia, which in the latter stages turned to Alzheimer's. So I understand this pretty well as far as the day-to-day life of this disease. But I'm curious on, with your research, are you studying people who are kind of progressing with the disease? And for example, for like my father, he, as his disease progressed, behavior started to become a big hurdle for him. And I think that's somewhat common for a percentage of people who have this disease. Are you studying not just the behaviors that come forward, but in your research, do you also do kind of looking at other comorbidities for these folks? Like, actually, my father ended up having cancer as well, lung cancer, and I can't help but think that some of the behaviors were because of pain. He just could not communicate the pain that he was experiencing. He did communicate them, but with behaviors. So I'm wondering, in your research, are you kind of tracking people as they go through the progression of their disease and then looking at other things outside of their brain health, but some of their physical health?
That's a really excellent question. My own research doesn't focus so much on, because it's a really different population, as you've pointed out, on patients. But I am very fortunate in that I partner with and am colleagues with a lot of people, particularly in the School of Nursing, who are doing patient-centered work on helping to understand how caregivers and patient pairs communicate and how those communications help the patient with their quality of life and how they're able to communicate and how they're feeling on a different day. All of these things that, as you mentioned, become so much more important than just the memory in the later stages of the disease. And I think that you've kind of hit the nail on the head with, you know, you clearly understand a lot, and the best researchers in this area are taking their cues from talking to caregivers, because it's the caregivers who are there day in and day out who know. I think that there is good research going on. I'm sorry that I can't direct you toward it. I do want to mention my colleague Andrea Gilmore as someone who has focused on this area, and recommend that you maybe give her a Google. But I can tell you that this is an area where people who are really bright and committed and dedicated are focusing right now.
And thank you so much, Angie, for that question and for calling. And Megan, thank you so much for being with us today. Boy, the time flew by. The Wisconsin Alzheimer's Institute, That's the website to go to for things like that RAP program or getting signed up for that or for other information about Alzheimer's.
It's a great, that website is a great research for, or resource for both people caregiving for someone with dementia, for people who are concerned about their own memory health. There's links to clinics and for people who are interested in research opportunities. Yeah, it's a catch-all. It's wonderful.
Well, I hope you'll come back and be with us again.
Ah, I would love to. Thank you for having me. And thanks to all of the callers for the great questions.
Megan Zielsdorf, an assistant professor at the UW-Madison School of Nursing, and she's an investigator in the Wisconsin Alzheimer's Disease Research Center. Interesting topic, and we'll get her back and we'll talk about this again. We're going to turn our attention to your heart. A diagnosis of heart disease can be scary, but does it necessarily mean you need to rush into health decisions? We can talk about that with the author of a new book called Heart Health, next on the Ideas Network.